Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Anna Staver, where we share stories about science, technology, and the future of our environment. Instagram is changing its rules for teenagers on the platform, converting them to private accounts, limiting private messaging, and giving parents more say over what they see. The company says these rules will make the platform safer for minors. Critics call it a last-minute effort to avoid federal regulation. Naomi Nix is a tech reporter for The Washington Post, and she's been covering this. Welcome to All Sides, Naomi.
Thanks for having me.
Can you walk us through the changes Instagram is making for its minor users?
Sure. So essentially, Instagram has created a new program that's calling Teen Accounts, where it largely streamlines some of its existing safety precautions for teenagers and adding some new ones. And so what this looks like is Instagram is going to be continuing to limit some of the sensitive content, like content that's violent or particularly sexually graphic. It's going to allow parents to set time limits for their teenagers. So if they want to limit their teenager's ability to, go on Instagram in certain times of the day, they can do that, or for a certain amount of time, they can do that. They're also continuing to limit the way adults can reach out to teenagers that they don't know, and they're making their accounts private. And they've also essentially created this division. So teenagers who are under 16 and want to change some of their settings will have to have their accounts supervised by their parents, who will allow them to do that. Whereas those older teenagers will be able to change some of those settings.
They say it's about essentially sparking a conversation, right? Bringing parents more into the loop of what their kids are doing on Instagram.
Yes. So for instance, one of the new things that parents will be able to see if they're supervising their teen's account is they'll be able to see who that teen was recently messaging with. And if it's someone that they, maybe have some suspicions about, the idea would be that they could have a conversation with their teenager about that person.
And they can also see what they're searching for or what kind of content they're getting.
Exactly. So Instagram's idea of trying to make this a little more attractive to teenagers is giving them a choice, a screen, to allow them to choose the kind of content they want to see on Instagram and the kind of topics, whether it's like sports or arts. And so all teenagers will get to make that choice. But then if they're being supervised for the parents will know what they chose to get some idea of what they're seeing on the social media network.
So how do they capture underage users? Because it is very easy to just say, yes, I'm 18 and create an adult account.
Yes. Teenagers are quite resourceful, and so they definitely know how to get around those rules. In this case, what Meta has said is they're going to be using AI to capture some of the teenagers they know might be lying about their age through signals. So for instance, it could be that you've checked 18, but everybody on one day is wishing you happy 14th birthday. That's a signal to Meta that you're not 18. And so they're going to be using, or continuing to use rather, an outside contractor called Yoti to do age verification. And so they're, And Yoti requires you to do like a video selfie or upload your government ID. And so they're basically saying, we're going to take precautions to ask teenagers more often when, to verify their ages.
So this is getting rolled out all across the globe. When is it going to take effect for American teenagers?
So within 60 days, Meta has said they're going to be sort of, beginning to roll this out. And what that means is it's going to apply to all teenagers. And so some that includes people who are newly signing up for the Instagram accounts and those who already are on Instagram, which is a pretty notable shift for the company. The company has typically not wanted to change the safety standards or settings for existing users. But every teenager is going to get a warning that this is happening. Whether they're excited about it or not.
These changes were announced prior to a House committee meeting for the Kids Online Safety Act, which passed the Senate in July. And Tennessee Senator Marsha Blackburn said, quote, "Just like clockwork, the Kids Online Safety Act moves forward and industry comes out with a new set of self-enforcing guidelines." It seems like people are a little suspect about the timing of this announcement.
Yes, it was, you know, taking place before that markup of that bill. And look, that bill faces some steep odds to pass Congress this time around. You know, I don't think I need to inform anyone. There's an election going around. We have precious few days to pass a bill. But the reality is Meta has the drumbeat of regulation on youth safety issues has among regulators has continued to just get higher and higher. And they're facing lawsuits from dozens of state attorneys generals over how they've handled youth safety issues. Congress, there is a lot of bipartisan agreement that there does need to be a bill, you know, that passes. President Biden has indicated that he would sign that bill. And so it is likely no coincidence that a company that for years had been dragged for not even asking people to state their ages when they signed up for an Instagram account is now suddenly, you know, creating all these new programs and safety protocols for its youngest users.
Yeah, and the Kids Online Safety Act, there was a hearing in the Senate earlier this year where its CEO, Mark Zuckerberg, was essentially told to stand up and apologize to the parents in the room. So that's the legislation that we're talking about. That's the context here.
Yeah, that was, we're seeing an emboldened movement of parents, right, who were in the room that day, who are saying, look, social media and particularly Meta's properties has really hurt my kid, whether they found drugs, you know, and overdosed, or whether they were targeted by a predator who groomed them and then abused them, or whether they just simply got addicted and, you know, found a lot of content about self-harm and suicide and ended up, you know, harming themselves, bullying, you name it. The list of concerns I think activists have and some regulators have about the effect of the platform, you know, is long.
Yeah, especially with the birth of the algorithm that feeds you more and more of what you're interested in. There were some really harrowing stories shared about teens who, say, were struggling with self-harm but had searched for it, and then the algorithm fed them more and more dangerous content.
Yes. And so that's like one area where the new teen accounts don't actually address. You know, what critics are saying is like, you know, this is a lot of them are saying this is good. I'm glad you're doing this. But there are some issues that are seemingly being unaddressed. And so one of them is that sort of infinite scroll where you're just continually being fed, you know, more and more and more content. The company is alerting teenagers when they've spent an hour or more on the platform, but they can just bypass that and continue to
see. It's like my time limits. I'm like, let's ignore that.
I do too. And so for some people, they might work. For others, they might not work. You know, the company is also alerting, you know, teenagers if it's like, they're no longer notifying them if they between the hours of 10 p.m. and 7 a.m. with the idea that like maybe they won't check the app while they should be sleeping. Of course, they may check it anyways. And so like, again, sort of one of several areas that, you know, some critics are saying that this Instagram teen account approach won't fully solve.
Yeah. A number of states, including Ohio, have passed laws that are all tangled up in legal fights, right? Like they're not actually in effect, restricting access of teenagers to social media. Utah in particular they were just going to turn it off between 10 p.m. and I think 6 a.m. So there is this conversation about like, should they not have access? But I don't know, best practice from everyone I've talked to is nobody should keep their phone in their bedroom. Everybody should charge them somewhere else and get a better night's sleep.
Yes. And I think that's one of the tough issues about parental controls is, and one thing you actually see in Meta's like own research about how parents feel about supervising their kids' online activities is, you know, one of the things you might hear is they feel also addicted to their phones and have a tough time enforcing rules against their children when their hands are also tied to those devices. And so it just goes to show you that like this is a problem that affects teenagers, but it's also a problem that affects us all.
There's also conversations about the regulation of TikTok. I mean, some of that goes further than just restricting what teens can access on TikTok to restricting what all of us can access on TikTok. Are there conversations about other social media platforms, particularly the ones that appeal to younger users?
Yes. It's a good point. I mean, politically, I think the conversation about Meta got started and youth got started earlier, in part just because Meta's platforms have been so popular. But also because there was a whistleblower, Frances Haugen, a couple of years ago, who unearthed a lot of internal documents showing the negative impacts of Instagram on young people. But that conversation has now among regulators really expanded to all the platforms, really. YouTube, TikTok, we're seeing attorneys general, Snapchat as well. We're seeing attorneys generals investigate those platforms. We're seeing lawsuits being filed against some of those platforms about the effects there. TikTok is, right, there's concerns about national security, but there's also concerns about like that endless, algorithm in which it sort of feeds you more and more content and teenagers getting stuck on that. I think there are some, regulators who've been concerned about TikTok and some of the challenges, the TikTok challenges, and how they're kind of, some of them are kind of dangerous.
Yeah, the dances are pretty harmless. Some of the other ones are not so fun.
Yeah, dances are okay. But there's some concerns there that go beyond just national security. YouTube Kids also, what kind of content are young people being exposed to there? Snapchat, right? Like there's been concerns around drug dealers finding kids in that place. And then you have a sort of disappearing message format that makes it difficult to track. And so we're seeing more concerns about that. And yet also, I think it's important to point out that the tech companies themselves continue to see young people as a critical demographic for their growth. At a time in the industry when profits haven't been a sure thing, there have been some bumps in the road there.
Yeah. So Meta seems to be the first company to really roll out a series of teen protections. Do you expect other companies will follow suit?
Yes. So we have been seeing a trend about companies releasing more parental control tools. Discord famously did not agree with the approach of allowing, a parental control tool. They have now released their own. Snapchat has some. TikTok and YouTube also have their own. And we've increasingly been seeing new announcements along this front, even just this past month with YouTube. And so I think the question, though, becomes, will they be used? Right now, what we know is parental control tools, even when offered, a very tiny percentage of teens actually end up enabling their accounts to be supervised. And even those who do, parents typically don't change the settings. The Post reported earlier this year that it was less than 10% for Instagram back in 2022. Snapchat, the Snapchat CEO, Evan Spiegel, told Congress that essentially there was like a 2% adoption rate. And so the question is, as companies continue to like release these parental control tools, will parents use them? Will they take advantage of them? Do they find them easy to use? Do they feel like they can keep up with all the different tools for all the different platforms, amid their busy schedule?
That is a really good question. Like, do you have the time to sit down and go app by app and think about it, have a conversation with your partner, maybe decide how you're going to manage these accounts when, yeah, that feels like a lot of work.
It is. And think about it like from an adult perspective, even if you don't have kids, how often do you go into your settings of every app you have to look at your privacy settings, for instance, and figure out what works best for you? Whatever hurdles, I know I certainly don't always take the time to do that as much as I should, even being a tech reporter. And so I imagine that lots of people will find that difficult to do. And then, there's concerns around equity, which parents know about the setting concerns and do they feel fully equipped to be able to make those decisions?
That was Naomi Nix, a tech reporter for The Washington Post. Thank you for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, how the exploding pagers in Lebanon worked and why you don't have to worry about your own phone. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
The candidates for November are set.
I know Donald Trump's tight.
Between now and Election Day.
We are not going back.
A campaign season unfolding faster.
Kamala Harris is not getting a promotion.
Than any in recent history.
Make America great again.
Follow it all with new episodes every weekday on the NPR Politics Podcast.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Anna Staver, where we share stories about science, technology, and the future of our environment. Thousands were injured and at least 25 people were killed after a series of explosions across Lebanon earlier this month. The explosions were carried out in pagers and walkie-talkies used by Hezbollah. And Israel is suspected of being the culprit, though they have not taken credit for the attacks. Joining me now to talk about it is Wired senior writer Lily Hay Newman. Welcome back, Lily.
Thanks for having me.
I want to start with the basics of what we know. So let's start with the pagers. So earlier this month, a series of pagers just literally exploded all at once all over Lebanon. Tended to be in the Beirut suburbs, but there were some spread out. What do we know about those pagers? How did they get in the hands of Hezbollah? How were they manufactured? Like, what information do we have?
Right. So they were exploding over the course of about an hour, I believe, in kind of a wave. And, you know, this was a model of pager that was, you know, had a model number that was traced to a Taiwanese pager company called Gold Apollo. But they aren't actually the manufacturer of these pagers. You know, they designed them. I believe they manufactured them in the past, but recently, obviously, this is old technology that's, you know, gone, changed hands a lot over the years at this point. So now a company called BAC Consulting, which is a Hungary-based company, had like a contract, you know, and the schematics to produce this model of Gold Apollo pager. And reportedly that company and a couple of other shell companies in a sort of supply chain to produce and distribute these pagers were owned and controlled by Israel.
So they built these pagers and allegedly they put small explosive devices inside of them, correct? It wasn't a regular pager. There was a bomb in it, basically.
Yes. Yeah, so BAC Consulting reportedly was also taking on normal clients and manufacturing normal Gold Apollo pagers, you know, of this model. But additionally, the reports indicate that they were modifying special batches of the pagers for this operation to supply Hezbollah with the compromised pagers, and that was explosives that were kind of laced into the battery of the pager.
Yeah, that was one of the concerns initially, was there some special code or corrupt message that caused the battery to overheat and explode? It does not appear that that was the case.
Right, and, you know, it is possible to do a sort of cyber physical attack where you overheat a battery, you know, by sending certain requests or certain commands to a device repeatedly if there's a flaw that can be exploited to, you know, overtax the battery and cause it to explode. But that not only did that not seem to be the case here in terms of how the explosions appeared and, you know, what seemed to be going on, they didn't seem to be battery fires exactly. But now, you know, further reporting has shown that this was actually the chain of how this happened.
Yeah, I know there was some consternation and concern just amongst not that people use pagers are kind of uncommon these days. I think that's safe to say. Most of us have switched to cell phones. But there was concern about, like, could I get a text message that would overheat my phone, make my phone explode? It seems like that's not very likely, or at least not in the tragic way that these exploded.
Right. You know, I think, first of all, sort of mainstream consumer devices, as you're saying, it's a different thing from something like pagers. Pagers are still used in healthcare. You know, it's not completely random or something that Hezbollah thought to use them. They are used in certain contexts. They are very reliable. They aren't necessarily traceable in the way that Hezbollah was concerned that Israel might be tracing their smartphones, their cell phones, you know, location tracking, and also compromising those devices to view their communications. So, you know, there's a reason that they chose them. But yes, as you're saying, because it's a historic technology, and because of what I was describing about, you know, different companies have licenses to now produce this, like, very legacy tech, it did create a more openings to do something like this versus, you know, mainstream smartphones that have, like, a high demand and are kind of flying off the shelves. This is more of, like, a backwater supply chain, maybe you could say.
And then there was a second wave of explosions with walkie-talkies. And it appears as if this is a similar story to the pagers, where there was a supply chain corruption.
Yes, and I at least have a little less insight at this point into, you know, exactly the model of the walkie-talkies. And but I think, as you're saying, this appears to be part of the same operation. And, you know, like I was saying, for the manufacturer of the pagers, there were sort of multiple shell companies and front companies involved in that. So, you know, it seems to be the case that a similar operation or compromise, you know, happened for the walkie-talkies.
Yeah, I saw in an article, the manufacturer of the walkie-talkies was like, no, these are counterfeit. They didn't have our special holographic seal. They're like, the model, like, has certain safety things that assure you it's authentic. So these were inauthentic copies of a common walkie-talkie. So, yeah, it sounds like a very similar story. And the company who manufactures them is like, no, that wasn't ours.
Right. And, you know, that, the question that is on everyone's minds, both, you know, folks on the ground in Lebanon dealing with the paranoia and, you know, horror of these attacks, and people around the world wondering, could someone overheat, you know, my phone battery or whatever, it comes to everyone's minds, you know, could any device I'm using be weaponized in this way? And perhaps, you know, theoretically it is possible, but I think the takeaway is that, you know, the fact that Hezbollah was concerned about their sort of normal, quote unquote, mainstream technology being compromised and intentionally sort of wanted to change modes and go to these other devices, that was what created the opening. It wasn't just sort of magically out of the blue.
Yeah, and I mean, the pictures that were shared to social media and across news sites were horrific. People with their hands blown off, like parts of their waist. People died, including a young child who was close by at the time of the attack. These were big, big explosions, bigger than what you would expect from an overheating battery, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
Exactly. And while to a degree, these are very targeted attacks in the sense that the owner of the device is typically holding or wearing the device and, you know, was sort of at the center of these explosions. I mean, it's horrific regardless. But even though it was sort of targeted in that way, these were, as you're saying, still huge explosions. And there is still collateral damage and civilians, you know, who were injured, killed, maimed by these attacks, and including, I believe, multiple children. I mean, it's really, you know, not a like battlefield situation. These were just people in the community with whoever bystanders happened to be around.
Yeah, there were videos in grocery stores and in streets and in homes. It was wherever you were at the moment holding that pager, that's where it went off.
Exactly.
One of the experts you interviewed, named Zachary Kallenborn, I hope I'm saying that correctly, with the Center for Strategic and International Studies, said that he thinks military targets will be the longer-term strategy here, not civilians. Can you unpack that a little bit?
Yeah, I think he's speaking to what we were just discussing about the paranoia that anyone could understandably have that, you know, anything with a battery, anything with room inside the box, you know, there could be stuffed with explosives. And I think, you know, the big thing here is it's not at all to glorify this operation, but it is very novel and shocking and surprising
and sophisticated. They allegedly were spending what? They spent like 2 years planning this out?
Exactly. Yeah, I believe the first shipments of pagers reportedly went to Hezbollah in summer 2022, I think. So, you know, it's a long time, as you're saying. So, you know, given the sort of novelty and investment in this attack, I think everyone is feeling that there will probably be inspiration drawn from this in other conflicts. And, you know, so does that mean that just every gadget is going to be a bomb, basically? And I think what he was saying is that most likely because of the investment, you know, and the foresight and advanced planning and everything that you're describing that goes into an operation like this, that it's most likely to, if it manifests again, something like this, it's most likely to show up in another existing conflict or, you know, on in sort of a battle type condition rather than just your refrigerator randomly explodes or something.
Yeah, I think it's part of the reason people very quickly suspected Israel, because to pull off a coordinated attack like this requires so much prep that may be beyond the scope of a small terror network or even an individual with a grudge, like an axe to grind.
Right. It's true, because it involves both the sort of technical side, the access on the technical side, and then also distribution. Like you have to, you know, manufacture or compromise these devices somewhere along the way in the supply chain and then get them into the right hands.
And then verify, you know, that they're in the right hands before you do this.
Right, exactly. So yeah, the logistics are substantial.
What do you think this means for the future of technology in war? Because as you said, this may be something that states, nations take on in the future. Is it kind of the dawn of a new era?
Well, supply chain attacks, I mean, I think it's a great and important question and a big question. But supply chain attacks are not new, both, you know, hardware or, you know, physical supply chain attacks or software supply chain attacks, you know, finding sort of a backdoor and compromising software and distributing it out to everyone. So it's not entirely unprecedented, but I think it will just deepen existing concerns about globalization and international manufacturing. And, you know, can one country trust a technology manufactured in a different country that may be, you know, geopolitically at odds with them, or that, you know, may actively be, you know, a tension there. For example, this has come up with, you know, technology exchange between the U.S. and China. And, you know, should the U.S., for example, incorporate 5G tech made by the company Huawei into critical infrastructure? So I think these discussions, you know, will only be fueled by this.
Yeah, this may be a little bit beyond your scope, but obviously, like, the country of Lebanon is talking about revenge, so is Hezbollah. But it does sort of ask this question of how do you secure technology, regardless of whether you're Hezbollah or Lebanon or even an individual? Because I have to imagine if you are living in Beirut right now, you're probably afraid of every piece of technology that you encounter, or at least wary of it.
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, I think that is very understandable and, you know, reasonable. As I said, I think in a lot of cases, again, for like mainstream devices like smartphones and laptops that are, you know, being what's called torn down, like teardowns, where you see the components for review purposes, or, you know, hobbyists or people who are interested in the tech, it would be pretty difficult to hide explosives, for example, in mainstream devices. Some people have made some really good points. I've seen some research breakdowns that it's not impossible, particularly if you're hiding the explosives in the battery, which people typically, they're doing the teardown of the whole gadget, not then going into the battery and doing a teardown of the battery. So, you know, that's a good point. But in those write-ups that I've seen, the modifications that they're describing to be totally invisible, it takes like thousands of words to explain how you would do it. So it kind of goes back to, you know, what you were saying before, that it's not impossible, but it just requires a really funded, concerted operation over time to do something like this. So it likely can't happen all the time in every device.
That was Lily Hay-Newman, senior writer at Wired. Thanks for joining us today.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Coming up, how do you turn off those annoying campaign texts that we all get this time of year? That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
The candidates for November are set.
I know Donald Trump's tight.
Between now and Election Day.
We are not going back.
A campaign season unfolding faster.
Kamala Harris is not getting a promotion.
Than any in recent history.
Make America great again.
Follow it all with new episodes every weekday on the NPR Politics Podcast.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. If you've ever donated to a political candidate or a cause, you most likely kept receiving messages long after you made that donation. Automated messages are now a key part of political outreach, even if you don't donate. But you can turn them off, and here to tell us how is Managing Editor for Commerce at CNET, Russell Holly. Welcome back, Russell.
Thank you.
So it's an election year, in case nobody noticed, and there is a lot of talk about fundraising and getting out the vote, and the ads are all over television, YouTube, Hulu, Netflix. But these automated messages are now a major part of political engagement with voters. What kind of increase are we seeing in these annoying texts?
It is a massive increase. And unfortunately, there's not like a solid number because it varies quite a bit by state. And if you are in a swing state, you're going to get way more text messages than most other folks. So it's going to vary depending on where you are. But if you're getting a whole lot more of them, they're, you know, it's likely not going to stop until well after November.
How are we getting them? Because it's not just donating. I don't donate to political campaigns because of my job, but I don't know how they're getting me sometimes, but my gosh, they're coming in.
Yeah, so it's a little different for folks like you and I because our names and numbers are on different lists. But for folks who are sitting at home and are, you know, kind of wondering how it is that they got some of these things, some of it is, you know, when you donate to places like either Act Blue or Win Red or, you know, some of the other, you know, different fundraising groups, there's often a whole bunch of contact information that they want you to put in. It's important to remember that only the things that have the stars next to them are mandatory, and never is the phone number mandatory. So you don't actually have to give someone your phone number in the first place. Often email is more than enough, and emails are way better than text messages at filtering out some of those things that you don't want to see, because texts, we just have a little less control over how that system works in general. So my first bit of advice to folks is when you're filling out those forms, just pay attention to what is actually required. If you don't have to give your phone number to somebody, don't do it.
Yeah. And if you have given your phone number to somebody, if you are now stuck with the unending text messages, how do we get rid of them?
There's two different things that I tend to recommend. The first is always kind of the most obvious one. try that stop to end function. Almost every text message that gets sent out by law has to include that, you know, send stop in all caps and we'll stop sending you text messages. It doesn't seem like it works every time, and that's because not everybody plays by the rules. And that's why the second bit of advice that I give is there's an organization called the Anti-Phishing Working Group. And what you can do is you can take screenshots of text messages arriving after you receive that stop confirmation. It's a really simple email address. It is reportphishing, that's phishing spelled with a PH, at APWG.org. And they will actually lobby on your behalf to get yourself removed from those lists.
I appreciate that level of pettiness.
It is a little more work to get that done, but I have actually tested it myself, and it does, in fact, work.
Yeah, I wonder how effective are these messages in actually getting people to donate or get registered or do whatever the command is in the text message?
There's got to be a group of people that are interested and respond to these messages. I am not one of them, and to be perfectly honest, I don't know anybody in my immediate social circle who is. We all seem kind of generally annoyed by unexpected text messages, regardless of whether it is a political thing or someone telling me that, you know, there's something on sale somewhere. But, you know, for the most part, you know, these keep getting sent out, so somebody's got to be responding to them.
Yeah, I get those too. Those from like, oh, I bought a thing from this company and they have my phone number and now I'm getting all these like text messages about stuff. Or if you sign up for delivery texts, suddenly you've gotten all these advertising texts.
That is exactly right. Yeah, it's always very careful about where you put your phone number.
Yeah, it's annoying as all get out. Let's move on to TikTok. There is a looming January 19th deadline for TikTok in the U.S. to shut down or sell to a non-Chinese owner. Last week, three federal judges heard arguments from TikTok and some high-profile content creators. What did they say? What is the argument against this ban?
Yeah, so right now it is essentially TikTok and a select group of people who work with TikTok as creators in one fashion or another. Against the Department of Justice. And so in this three-panel session, what we know so far is that, you know, that there didn't really seem to be any obvious lean in one direction or another when it came to the kinds of questions that were being asked. Both the Department of Justice and TikTok seemed to be pretty heavily scrutinized for the decisions that were made leading up to this process. So it's not like watching the hearing gave you, you know, kind of any clear indication of what exactly is going to happen. It may be a couple of weeks still before any of the results of this come out. But, you know, the bulk of the argument here is that TikTok claims that this is a First Amendment issue in that, you know, these folks who have essentially built businesses using this platform are not going to be able to operate them and not be able to communicate effectively with audiences, while the Department of Justice maintains that this is a security issue. However, in a public court hearing, a lot of the information that they gave was that this is classified information. However, you know, this is the result that we determined based on that classified information. So very little actual information on what the Department of Justice perceives as threats were clearly, you know, kind of discussed. But that is, you know, all part of this hearing that is expected to hopefully have some resolution before the end of October.
So it sounds like the federal government is like, trust us, it's dangerous.
The trust us, it's dangerous line has been the line for the Department of Justice and Congress as a whole for more than a year at this point. And there's just been very, very few details as a result. And that makes, folks at home trying to form an opinion on this pretty difficult.
Yeah. I wonder if the judges have any more access to that kind of stuff than the public at large.
The D.C. Circuit Court tends to deal with classified material more often than most, given their proximity to, you know, kind of lawmakers and things like that. So it's likely that they do have more information. But based on that, it's really interesting that the line of questioning for TikTok wasn't more, you know, kind of speculative in the way that, you know, information gets provided. So it's really tough to say.
Yeah, and I won't ask you to predict what the three-judge panel is going to do because that never works out well.
It's very true, yeah.
What has the Chinese owner, ByteDance, said about the feasibility of selling to a U.S. company?
ByteDance has made it really clear that it's more or less impossible to sell. You know, the thing that makes TikTok interesting is its algorithm. So even if ByteDance were to sell TikTok the platform, it certainly would not sell the algorithm that makes it functional. So if a company like Microsoft were even able to buy it, it would not be the same TikTok that folks who use it today understand as far as how it works.
And then that sounds like your followers, your content, it doesn't. That might not port over to a new platform.
Yeah, it's really difficult to see, you know, what the benefit for either side would be in an exchange like that, other than to keep a thing called TikTok available for US audiences. But, you know, if it ends up, you know, not functioning the way that it is supposed to function once that transition has happened, users are just going to leave for other platforms.
Yeah, this is more than a rose by any other name.
That's correct.
So billionaire Frank McCourt is pitching investors on the idea of creating a new platform. What is he proposing?
Yeah, the new platform is, again, it you know, the goal here is, you know, short form video where folks can, you know, kind of share their own opinions and you know, the topic of free speech keeps coming up and being swatted down amidst all of these discussions for being able to share whatever opinions you might have on this platform. But it is still missing the thing that makes TikTok popular in the first place, which is being able to recommend things that are actually interesting to you as the person who is continuing to swipe. TikTok's algorithm, whether you like the platform or don't like the platform, is very, very good at targeting you specifically with things that you would be
interested frighteningly good.
Watching. It's so good at it. And, you know, that technology is the bit here that no matter what happens next, an American company is not going to have access to. So it is, you know, a concept that is largely a someone with quite a bit of money saying, well, what if I did this? But the underlying tech is still the thing that nobody has solved for.
You know, for all the politicians talk about banning TikTok, they're certainly making a lot of use of it this election season.
It is very true. Yeah, there's quite a bit being used, not just when it comes to, you know, their own platforms where they can share their own messages, but several stories about how political campaigns have been buying influence with other creators that are quite popular across TikTok and Instagram. You know, so clearly these platforms are of interest because they reach the widest possible audience right now. A lot of the people who are on TikTok 24/7 do not watch traditional television. So, you know, this is a really important avenue for them.
Yeah. I mean, we've talked about it on this show before, but at the RNC and the DNC, for the first time, they credentialed influencers, some of which were big TikTok influencers, invited them. They got a lot of perks that regular journalists did not get at those. So there's a recognition, like, whether we like them or not, that it is an effective way of communicating to demographics they're trying to reach.
Even earlier this week, one of the biggest, you know, news commentators on TikTok, V. Spihar, was in the White House briefing room, you know, as a part of the briefing for this week. Like, this is clearly a thing that is going to continue to grow and take shape. And that's a really complicated thing to have happen, you know, right at the same time as a conversation about removing the platform that, you know, gave these people an audience is a separate conversation.
Yeah, so the deadline is January 19th. I assume we'll probably get a decision from this three-judge panel before then.
Almost assuredly.
Do you think it's going all the way to the Supreme Court?
I think that if this doesn't go in TikTok's favor right away, that the next step would be the Supreme Court. But whether the Supreme Court would entertain that hearing before January 19th is very much an open question.
But they could put a stay on it, right, while they were considering it. So that would hold off, possible. Essentially, postpone indefinitely until the court reaches a verdict.
Yeah, if they decided to make that decision, then absolutely. But there's also no guarantee that that would happen.
Yeah, I'm not, again, we are not in the habit of predicting what any court is going to decide. It never goes well.
That's right.
So Apple recently released its iPhone 16 Pro and Pro Max. Let's just start with the simple question. What are the new features? Like, why would I want to upgrade if I have a 15?
Yeah, so the big things that Apple has leaned into with the iPhone 16, there is one great big hardware feature and a whole bunch of software features. And the frustrating thing about the software features is that most of them are not ready yet. Apple's leaned really heavily into what it calls Apple Intelligence, where it's able to, you know, kind of do a whole bunch of things and predict a bunch of things for you and you know, kind of make your life sort of generally easier on your phone. But if you go and pick up an iPhone right this second, those features are not currently available to you. And they won't be available in some cases until January, which is a little on the frustrating side. Now, one of the things Apple has said is that all of this AI work is going to just require a lot more power on your phone, you know, as far as doing all of this local processing so that there isn't a server somewhere kind of gobbling up all of your data. And what that means is that your phone in the background is just going to be doing a lot more than it has before. And they have compensated for this by putting a much larger battery in this phone. So for people who buy an iPhone right this second, one of the things that you hear from a lot of folks who have it is, man, the battery life on this thing is so great. I get almost 2 days of battery out of this thing when I use it the same way that I use my other phone. How cool is this? It's really worth highlighting that that battery life is probably going to go down quite a bit once some of this Apple Intelligence stuff becomes available. We don't know, you know, what that impact is going to be.
So if you don't upgrade, can you still get the Apple Intelligence? Like, can you get the software upgrade on a 13, 14, 15?
Yeah, so there's limits to what's going to be available on some of the other phones. We know that the 15 and the 14 are going to have access to versions of Apple Intelligence, but not always the like always on listening, you know, kind of functionality that you have with Siri. That is something that will be limited in its access for other versions of the iPhone. But you'll still have access to a bunch of those features, especially, you know, being able to type instead of talk to access Siri. Which as someone who spends quite a bit of time on a train is a thing that I personally really enjoy.
Apple isn't the only one integrating AI into their phones. We're seeing it a lot from Google too.
That is exactly true. Google has leaned really heavily for really the last 10 years into having software not just enhance photos, but also make recommendations for when you should leave your house to get to an appointment that you have in your calendar, which is a feature that I find particularly useful. And that is just increasing. And, you know, being able to make recommendations for how to improve photos and being able to make AI changes to photos and, you know, really a lot of...
Yeah, those ads have gotten me. I've been an Apple user for, I don't know, 15 years now, but like that was like... The Google Pixel ads for like editing photos, I was like, oh, that's cool.
Easily one of the best features when it works on a Google phone or someone who has access to Google Photos is the ability to remove a person from the background of a photo. When it works, it is so smooth and it works really, really well, but it does not work 100% of the time. And when it gets it wrong, it's a really weird smudge in your photo where a person used to be, and that is not better.
That is totally fair. The update brings up an ongoing conversation about the communication between Apple and Android devices. Are we getting better communication for our group chats?
We are. If you have someone in your life who shows up on your phone as a green bubble, there is you should stop making fun of them right away. Now have all of the same features that you have access to through a tool called RCS. RCS is something that has been available as a part of Android and through Verizon and T-Mobile and AT&T for a while now. And you may have seen commercials from Google kind of making fun of Apple for not having this on their phones because it was such a kind of ubiquitous feature. It is now available, which means all of the kind of smart features that you can do, you know, when you like a comment that someone has said in a group chat or, you know, you've kind of set up an intelligent thing for multiple people to interact with. That is now something that regardless of what phone you have, it all works basically the same way.
I did want to circle back to the Apple Intelligence for a quick second, because I had another thought as somebody with an older iPhone. Well, it's a 14, so it's not like super old. But if I do the upgrade, is it going to kill my battery? Am I going to get like 3 or 4 hours instead of like 6 or 7?
It will reduce your battery if you are using those AI features constantly. So okay. If you are, you know, kind of regularly using it for that kind of stuff, it will definitely take a hit to your battery. But you have a choice. This isn't something that you're going to be forced to use on the iPhone. You can turn off the stuff that you don't like. And if you are someone who uses Siri regularly, like multiple times a day, you may notice that there is some battery drain there, but that's going to be as far as we understand it right now, the extent of it.
Okay. And even if you get the 16, you can turn off some of this Apple Intelligence?
Almost all of it has the ability to be turned off in settings.
Okay. Well, that's also good just in case you're concerned that your phone is listening to you all the time. This kind of makes it
exactly
a little more worrisome.
Yeah, Apple's definitely got a privacy-first approach to this, which is great. But one of the things that it doesn't talk about is you know, kind of the impact on your day-to-day activities when it comes to battery life. And that's a thing that we're going to be paying pretty close attention to.
Does the iPhone, the software update, do some of the things that we saw over this summer when Apple released, for example, the update to the calculator? So you can put in a formula and it'll solve it for you. Is that going to be available on the iPhone or is that going to be exclusively iPad?
That is something that will be available on the iPhone, but it will not work nearly as well on the iPad just because the iPad allows you to stretch it out and give you access to a whole lot more of those functions. As far as being able to solve things like that, it is definitely a feature that will still be available, but it'll be in that, you know, kind of smaller calculator format. So it'll be less convenient.
I do wonder what teachers are going to do with that when you're going to essentially be able to solve all of your problems on your phone. And because like a lot of kids these days will use their phone as their calculator if you're allowed to use a calculator. So I don't know, maybe they'll go back to like dumb calculators, or I had a graphing calculator. And so who knows?
So there's two things there that I'm going to do really quickly. One is that every teacher that I've talked to has decided that they're just going to collect phones before tests. And let that be the end of it. And the other thing that we didn't have time to talk about today is that somebody has actually hacked ChatGPT onto a TI-84 graphing calculator. which is
so sneaky,
very sneaky way to solve math problems using what looks like an ordinary calculator.
Oh my gosh, that is clever and also terrible, but clever.
Yes, it is. Seeing where that goes is going to be very interesting. But yeah, it's going to be a wild time for teachers as a whole. This is going to be especially, you know, teachers that do things like math and geometry and things like that.
That was Russell Holly, Managing Editor for Commerce at CNET. Thank you, as always.
Thank you for having me.
And thank you all for listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides, right here on 89.7 NPR News.